University, who will be speaking. The title of his talk is very simply "Seeing the Puppy Movement."
Actually, I'm going to talk for a while first, so you don't insist on the quality of the image. Maybe we needn't be plunged into darkness immediately. I guess I'm a textualist, and I feel acutely without the protection of a text this morning. I have not written out what I have to say to you, and that may have something to do with the fact that I only got 3 hours of sleep last night. Jet lag can also be called. It could be abject fear for the quality of the people sitting in the room. I'm not sure what it is, but in any case, please don't set too much store, if any, by what it is that I'm about to say orally. There is a text. I tried to write up for the conference itself. I know that most of us haven't probably had a chance to work through the text, but let me refer you to that. And also refer you, apropos of the subject in general, to an issue of the International Journal for Hindu Studies, which should be out in December and in digital form in November, called The Bhakti Movement - Says Who? The way I come into this is having been trying to think about recently the whole issue of where we got the idea that there ever was such a thing as the Bhakti Movement. It's written into every history that anyone has ever written in the course of the last X years. I think we can date that X back to about 1940, actually, when the conception of the Bhakti movement in rigorous conversation, active conversation with the Hindi notion, Bhakti Andolan, comes into being for the first time. It does have a history, but the history is not a history that has to do with movement or Andolan as such, but that goes in two directions. The way in which one can trace it probably most directly is to the idea of Vaishnavta in conversation with the notion of the Chatur Sampradaya, the four Sampradayas. That in turn is a notion that takes us back to about 1600 with Navadas and Anantadas, and is, I would argue, distinctly a northern notion, which is not even recognized in most of the South today. So we're dealing with a northern conception of the way in which the South can be appropriated as the sort of deep bhakti history of what then takes formation in the north. And I would go on to say that I think this has a lot to do with state formation. The year 1940, or actually a little bit earlier in the 30s, with certainly looking forward to the coming, the end of the British Raj and the coming of independence and the shaping of a cultural coherence based in the north that is looking to the south for its justification. So my first point would be that whenever you see those words, bhakti movement, written into any book, and I've done it myself, please begin to ask yourself the question, bhakti movement since when, and says who? So part of the history of that is the idea of the four sampradayas. The other part that comes into it, very interestingly, is this notion that bhakti was somehow born in the South. And that comes from a text, which I'd be very interested to know from any of you who are here. When does it, in fact, come to light? This is the Bhagavata Mahatmya, which is associated, obviously enough, with the Bhagavata Purana, whose glories it sings, but which is traditionally associated with the Padma Purana, actually. To my knowledge, this text doesn't come to be associated with the Bhagavata as such, in a written form, that's to say, in a manuscript form, in a textual form, till about the middle of the 19th century, and it may be actually almost or even directly in regard to the preparation of print. We don't have time for that today, but it's an interesting aspect of the story. At what point is this story of a hypostasized bhakti, who is, you know, utpana dravade sahamma, born in the Dravada country, at what point does this notion come to be associated with the later notion of bhakti as a movement, as an andolan? I'm sure it happens by 1940, once again, because it's in that year that the Dasguptas, Surendranath Dasgupta, I think rather closely with his wife, actually makes reference to that story of bhakti coming from south to north as they come into the third volume, which deals with, some other things, but basically Vaishnava notions of, sort of that brand, that band in Indian philosophy. And there specifically is a chapter on the Alwars, which are drawn rather, how shall I say, it's an innovative gesture to draw the Alwars themselves into this history of Indian philosophy. And as they do so, they make reference to this text from the Bhagavata Mahatmya. I happened a couple of days ago, working in the British Library, to come across a reference from Albrecht, who is describing the contents of the University of Leipzig Sanskrit collection. And there, in describing a particular Bhagavata Mahatmya, which exists as part of the Padma, as part of the collection there, dates to the 18th century, he does specifically make note of the fact that it includes this passage that we've just talked about, how Bhakti travels from south to north. So at least at that point, we know that already in 1901, someone had noticed this text as an interesting text, and I suspect that it goes back further in Bhagavat Saptah tradition, the performance of the Bhagavata Purana, but I don't know yet. So point number one is, please ask yourself the question, was there ever a Bhakti movement, in whose minds, and since when? Now, what brings us together today is not just, texts, of course, but the sort of conversation between texts and what can be seen or what is built. And there we have a problem with the conception of the Bhakti movement as such, because if we're thinking of someone like, say, Surdas as being involved in the Bhakti movement, that's fine. We have stories which tell us how it was that Sur, though he was blind, composed his poetry actually in a sort of direct channeling of the image of the deity to whom he was appealing and whom he was describing. So that describes a direct correspondence between the seen and the said. But with a poet like Kabir, let us say, who is also to be associated with the Bhakti movement, that falls away. So one thing that we could ask ourselves as a group, I suppose, is if you were looking for the sort of archaeology of Kabir, where in the world would you look? Here's a built tradition which depends on money, which depends on sampradayas and institutions that preserve these traditions. Where are we going to look for a person like Kabir? It's going to be very hard to find him, but maybe there are places that we haven't thought to look, or the archaeologists among you would know how to get at a question like this in a way that I don't. So the Bhakti movement, the idea of the Bhakti movement as a textual notion includes someone like Kabir, but as a visual notion would seem to exclude someone who doesn't have the resources to be able to, or isn't embraced by people who have the resources to be able to build temples. Building temples is really important. I spent time in Vrindavan, luckily. I went there for the first time 30 years ago. The place has entirely changed in the course of the last 30 years. It's now a part of Greater Metropolitan Delhi. It's part of a weekend schedule that brings people in and out. The pandas are entirely dislocated by what has happened here. And a very major temple has emerged as part of the minimal requirement for any pilgrim who comes to Vrindavan, and that is the temple of Krishna Balaram, of ISKCON, of the Hare Krishna movement, if I can use that word again. So obviously an expression of bhakti as a in institutional form, which has had the effect of reorienting pilgrimage practices in Vrindavan itself. When one wants to see bhakti, you can see it today in the temple of Krishna Balaram, which has quite reoriented things. But that... where am I going to finish my sentence here? Let's be conscious of the fact that places where bhakti happens are changing all the time. Sometimes changing very dramatically in response to relationships to bhakti as a notion that grasps the people who want to be there. Chris, how am I doing on time?
Another 10,
that's what I was afraid of. All right, let me at this point go, and I want to show you some images at some point. I want to just read this text to you, if I could, just, a couple of verses, and then just ask some questions about it, and then refer you, I guess, to the written form of the paper. So, from the Bhagavata Mahatmya, it's the first chapter in which bhakti is encountered by Narada, and he says, "Who are you?" She isn't looking up. She says, Utpanadravale saham vrittim karnatake gata. I think that's quite important. She attains her maturity in Karnataka. Kochit kochit maharashtre gurjurid. Are you ready for this? Jiyanatam gata. I became old in Gujarat. Not just old, but sort of torn up. Tatra gola kale yogat pakandai or pashandahi kanditangaka. Durbalaham chiram yata putrabhyam saham mandatam. These putrabhyam are Jnana and Vairagya, her sons. They're in really bad shape. And then, here comes the punchline. Brindavanam punah prapya navineva sarupani. So it's jirna odhara. She has been, you know, restored from her very specifically jirna condition. Jataham yuvati samyak preshtarupatu sampratam. I was born in Dravada, grew up in Karnataka, went here and there in Maharashtra, then in Gujarat, became old and worn. There, under the spell of these awful times, the Kaliyug, my body was riven by, well, schismatics, let's say. For long, I went about in this weakened condition, accompanied in lethargy by my sons, knowledge, or wisdom, and what? Dispassion. Vairagya. But on reaching Vrindavan, I was renewed. I became lovely once again. So that now I go about as I ought, a woman, a young woman of superb appearance. There are lots of interesting things one can ask about this text, you know, and people have asked. Of course, the people in Gujarat have been particularly incensed. And one urge that they have had has been to say, this Gurja, what is described in this text, it's not Gujarat, it's some other Gurja. And that's one strategy. But in any case, so there's that. Karnataka is quite important for the text as a whole. This is the beginning of the text, really, not the end. What happens at the end happens, and this one rarely hears, happens in Haridwar, of all places. It's, though bhakti has been restored to life in Vrindavan, it's not until the group gets to Haridwar that the sons come to life. But there's a sort of foreshadowing of this in the text, which has to do with a figure called Gokarna, who lives somewhere on the river Tungabhadra, and we aren't given the exact location, but I think it's quite important that it's there, and one wonders about Gokarna, whether this is some reference to the Shaiva site, which is not, of course, on the Tungabhadra, but in that general region. And then Haridwar also has Shaiva associations. Is there an implicit taking over of the Shaiva by the Vaishnava in this text? In any case, it's pointing forward to Haridwar, and the antecedent seems to be somewhere in the southwest. What else is to be said? Well, the striking thing, I suppose, is this whole business about reaching Vrindavan. Now, of course, Vrindavan is both laukik and alaukik, always alaukik and sometimes laukik. I think it's hard to read this text, this historical emplotment of the career of bhakti, without actually thinking we are referring to a built Vrindavan here. Well, so earlier scholars, Filiosa among them, said, okay, this probably was written in roughly the time of the building of Vrindavan, that's to say the 16th century. The manuscripts don't bear this out, actually. The earliest ones that I've been able to find, in any case, date to the early 18th century, the earliest one I can find, with one exception, which I think is a big problem, is 1714 in Baroda. So it's an 18th century text, I think. Referring back to a known Vrindavan, which I think it's impossible to imagine this as not being the built site that we see, and that's what's going to take us here. Namely, the site which was built not, how should I say, not a, there's reference to the Yavanas in this text, to, you know, Muslims, let us say, Turks, who otherwise are occluded from the text, so they only appear as enemies in the text. But if we look at the built Vrindavan, it clearly has to do, especially, not I think, with the Vallabhites, who are unable to locate in Vrindavan, actually. Vrindavan I know as Vrindavan, not for a while, but with the Gaudias. And the Gaudias, who are given in a farman that we know from the end of the 16th century, are given a sort of command over or administrative responsibility for the general disposition of monuments in Vrindavan on the part of the Mughal state. And in an inscription dated 1590 in the temple just opposite the temple of Govindadev, which I'll show you in a moment, Akbar himself is listed as the maker of this temple. So my thesis would be that when Vrindavan is described in this text, there's this sort of laundering of, but also appeal to the fact that one knows the built Vrindavan by the time this text is constructed. But it's impossible actually to imagine this built Vrindavan without the direct support of the Mughal state, in conversation, of course, with the fact that Man Singh is, you know, the most important general in Akbar's period, and Todad Mal is active and so forth. So I would say that the Vrindavan to whom, I would suggest, the Vrindavan to whom reference is made here, to which it's made here, is actually, when one thinks about it in sort of built terms, it's hard to imagine that we're not talking about the Vrindavan which was created with the advice and consent of the Mughal state, despite the fact that the text is trying to argue us back in the direction of a south which has no association with yavanas such as these. Now, I won't have time to go into the details of this, and I'm not competent to do many of them, but maybe we could pull down the lights at this point and just look at a couple of the... Chris, how am I in time? Not so good. Well, no, tell me. Let me just show a couple, okay? This is this beautiful photograph, I think, by Robin Beach of the interior of the Temple of Govindadev. Huge, huge structure. I'm talking with Adam about this morning. Just immense structure, the largest single-built structure, apparently, in India at its time. And there's some, you know, sort of discussion about whether these large public spaces had to do with bhakti worship, that's to say, congregational worship or not. There's a reference to the fact that Raghunath Bhatt actually performed the Bhagavata, recited the Bhagavata, in the presence of Rupa Goswami, himself, who was the adhikara of this temple. So the... Whoa. Ah, yes, that's right, because I don't have that one. Okay, some of the other examples of the old structures in town, this is Jugal Kishore, give you a sense of how we're dealing with a coherent vocabulary here, not just in the use of Mathura stone, but also in the way in which the stone is used. Interestingly, the argument has been made that, sorry for the focus here, the argument has been made that some of the structures inside the Temple of Govindadev are best explained by reference to earlier structures that were built in Gujarat itself. So, you know, the narrative of the text here doesn't seem to match what we get in the narrative of the place itself. And why did that happen? Because when the Mughals managed to, well, Man Singh actually managed to move in on the Shah of Ahmedabad, probably, or at least it's been argued, the many of the artisans who were at work in Ahmedabad were actually brought into the Mughal domain, although actually from the period of Jiva Goswami, we have the report that the architect himself had come from Delhi. But again, that it underscores the fact that we're dealing with a sort of Mughal bhakti, if we can call it that. Again, a place on the temple that's been referred by people who know far better than me to Gujarat as its antecedent. The Temple of Madan Mohan, I don't want to overemphasize Gujarat, this kind of plan. George Michel and others have said that this reminds more of structures in Gwalior and to the east than it would, however, and this is important, of the south, which would be implied if we were thinking of the ritual associations claimed by the Gaudiya Sampradaya, for example, in thinking about how they're constructing Vrindavan. That's a lineage that goes right straight back to Srirangam, with a little bit of a glitch because Gopal Bhatt himself actually never married. But in any case, it's an appeal to Srirangam, but the architecture of the built Vrindavan is not an appeal to Srirangam at all. So these are different souths we're talking about. I don't have time to do the rest of... what I wanted to, you know, what I've done in, here we go, this is what I want to get to. In the paper, there's a sort of general caution about trying to draw too close a correspondence between the seen and the said. They're important correspondences to be seen, but often they're rather indirect, and we have to be careful about which text is being referred to at what time. The Bhagavata Purana has often been said to be the text of reference for temples that are built before the 12th or 11th century, and I don't think that can be demonstrated in any case, at least I've not been able to see it. Those can all be associated with a Vishnu Purana or with a Harivansha, and not necessarily with the Bhagavata. So, general caution. Fast forward, bring me to two rather modern built texts for the Bhakti movement. One I haven't seen myself in person yet, but I'm going to soon. And this is the, there's a mistake in my written version, this is in the Hindi Bhavan, not unimportantly, the Hindi Bhavan of Shantiniketan, so 1946-1947, where, let me get his name right this time, it is not Majumdar, it is Mukherjee. Vinod Bihari Mukherjee does these murals in the Hindi Bhavan at Shantiniketan, and on three sides of the this wonderful book, which lays this out, three sides of the structure. This is the library of the Hindi Bhavan, where Hasan Prasad Dwivedi is sitting as the main figure. He's talking with Prithi Mohan Sen the whole time, and so forth. So it's a very important location for the production of the idea of the Bhakti movement itself. And you have these murals being painted. So this is Ramanuja, whom we've heard about just now, talking. And he's on the southern side, actually. Just opposite him on the northern side, we're going to see, guess who? Guru Gobind Singh, as the end, so to speak, of this story. And then what comes in between these two is, in a way, the story of Hindi. We have Kabir, off to the right. I'm wondering if this, where did the guy go? I don't think it's true, actually. I had wondered at one point whether this might be the supposed Ramananda on his way north. But Kabir we see already on the south, and then Tulsidas, mainly in the west. Clearly we're moving at the structure of it, and when the boats are sailing down the Ganges, we see them sailing in our direction. It's going from south to north around the western wall, and then when we arrive on the north, it's Surdas and Guru Gobind Singh. It's a very interesting picture of the Bhakti movement, but very definitely from a northern point of view once again. So there I would sort of ask us to think about Hazari Prasad Dwivedi and Prithi Mohan Sen as the textual analogs to what's been done in art. And then, I don't know, how many of you have been to this place? Shocking. Am I the only person in the room?
Haridwar.
Yeah. Am I the only person in the room?
Bharat Mata Mandir is in Banaras, Varanasi.
Ah, ye bhi hai. That's also true, but this is a better one. This is bigger, too. It's a very interesting structure. And they're very worried. I don't have time to show you the picture. If you haven't been, you know, as someone who's interested in temples, this is a really important one for the Bhakti movement. On the third and fourth floors, you have parsed out the Matar Mandir and the Sant Mandir. So, since this is Mataji, the sexes are separated with the exception of Sharada Devi, who, this is not your Sharada Devi, this is Sharada Devi of Ramakrishna, of course. Well, let me not get into that. In any case, she breaks into the Sant Mandir by virtue of her husband. I don't really have time to go into it. Here's the base floor, and very interestingly, it's Bharat Mata in a sort of iconic representation, and the Bharat Mata as a divinity. Once you get up to the, I want to end with Shankaracharya, once you get up to the Sant Mandir, maybe I can take you to the end of this, here's Kabir, Ravidas, and Ramakrishna. Once you get up to the Sant Mandir, it's going to be Shiva sitting up on the top of the temple itself. He's the authorizing deity. It is Haridwar, after all. So the whole idea of Bhakti movement, so to speak, is shaped in his image. Here we have the four acharyas, actually, that we would expect from the Chato Sampradaya. And right in the middle, whom do we see? Shankaracharya. So we have here a sort of visual representation that puts the Shaiva tradition right back in the middle of what really was a Vaishnava idea. Okay, everything that we've been talking about so far. He's back in. You could say, well, there is some background for that. But in relation to the idea of the four sampradayas, it's rather striking. Thank you very much.
There is time. Thank you very much for
that. Is there?
There is time for some questions.
Just go back to the slide.
Which one would you like?
The slide of the painting that you showed.
Yeah.
The thing of Damanjan is gigantic. Could you comment on that?
Is
there's a, you know, people have different heights.
Yes.
Could you please comment on that?
Oh, yes. No, he's huge.
Yes, he's a giant.
He is indeed, and the whole style is quite wonderful. He's much larger than anybody else on this train.
Yes, and also the other two next to him, whereas everybody else.
Yes, and what do you? Yes, and in fact, and then Kabir is going to appear on the right, and he's seated. The other people of his height are Tulsidas. This is, if I'd known, I was going to talk about this. Yeah, Tulsidas is fascinating. You see Tulsidas at this height, another major figure, and there's a sort of I don't know. Who it is that's with Tulsidas? It's a figure of equal height associated with fire, some sort of jyoti figure. I don't know. Is it Bhakti once again incarnate? In any case. And then finally, Surdas is of the same height. So definitely we have the parceling out of the most important bhaktas of the tradition. Ramanuja, Kabir, seated, Tulsidas standing in, Surdas, and then on a horse, Guru Gobind Singh. So,
So what you were saying, and thank you for a wonderful talk, is that if you historicize the Bhakti movement, right, you can posit that it is either an invented tradition or an imagined tradition, as Anderson would argue.
Yes.
Yeah, and you're really saying that it was constructed or invented or imagined in the political through the political movement of the 1940s.
That's correct.
Fantastic.
And but not without antecedent. You know, when you construct something, you have to have materials to construct it with. And as we know, not just individual materials, but sometimes it's convenient if a whole part of the building exists for you to be able to map into the next building. But we have that then with the institution of the four sampradayas. But the creation of this new building is distinct to its own time.
It's also, as a comment, that this building, because I'm a student now, spent long time in Shantiniketan and know the Hindi problem. I think it was from a period when Hindi became very important,
yes.
And the language-wise, they were fighting against the other languages, and that's why Tulsidas, Surdas, they were very important.
Yes, and I even wonder whether, and I wish I knew this, whether the Bengal location may not be more important than we think. So often, the precipitation of a majority tradition, the idea of England, let us say. I mean, it's been argued that by Sheldon Pollack, for example, that idea happened in France, and rather than in England as such, as a sort of consolidated institution. So here we would have Hindi imagined as the language to be used by the coming state, which happens, it does happen in the Hindi belt, but I think that maybe the Bengal component to this was quite crucial in having it happen as a national
because
institution.
Because it was supported by Tagore.
Yeah.
And he had a prestige.
Right.
And so the Allahabad group, seated in Hindi Bhavan, did that.
And then, as I tell you, it does go back to Banaras. One more and then we're done.
You said Shankara is a Shaivite. He's not a Shaivite.
Ah, this
he's
is a good
master. And he has given Govindashtakam on so many things in praise of Vishnu and Krishna and all that.
I completely agree. This is all Paul Hacker and the whole thing. I completely agree, but I must refer you to your wife on this. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you very much.
Okay. I'm not sure how to get into it.